Welcome to The Last Supper, your weekly podcast about art in Asia. I'm your host, Oscar Venhuis. Every weekend I sit down and release an episode bringing new perspectives and engaging dialogues with emerging and established artists, galleries, curators and collectors in Asia. Learn more about art in Asia with Christie's Education in-person and virtual art courses, gallery visits and webinars. Visit Christie's Education website and enter all in capital letters LASTSUPPER15 to enjoy a 15% discount. The website link and discount code for Christie's Education can also be found in the description of this podcast. In today's episode of The Last Supper, I sat down with artist Ting Ting Chen on the complexities of post-colonialism, the challenge of building your own island, her project that deals with inconclusive debates. We talked about fluidity in identity and how confusion around a simple interview request for Steel Art Festival turned into a new project. Hello Ting Ting, welcome to The Last Supper, and how are you today?
I'm fine, yeah. I guess, yeah. Are you also in Taiwan?
No, I'm not. I'm based on a small island called Lama Island.
Oh, the one in Hong Kong, right?
Exactly right.
Ah, cool, cool. So yeah, but I guess we are in the same time zone. So yeah, it's early morning Monday and we have some friends over. But it was all good. We didn't drink too much, so.
And you are calling from Taipei?
Yeah, I'm currently based in Taipei.
What's happening with the funky background that you have?
No, so what happened is I didn't expect to be, there's a camera. So I thought it was just audio, but then I realized where I am is very messy, just lots of cabinet and everything. So I just put the only type of these things behind me, so it would look a little bit neater, despite it's weird. That's the reason I was asking, is there going to be a video, because if it is, this is really weird as well, but it's way too messy behind me.
Let's begin today's episode with explaining who Ting Ting is.
So my name is Ting Ting Chen, originally from Taiwan. I have been based in Taipei, since I was born, and I moved to London in 2008. And then I went to study my first master in photography. And then I kind of just stayed there. I did another degree in fine art at some point, but basically I stayed there all the way until 2019. And in June 2019, I moved back to Taiwan. Yeah. And I've been a practice artist kind of since 2009 or something.
And what motivated you to move to the UK from Taiwan?
I think imagine, you're 22, graduated from university, and I think I never thought about I would stay for this long or stay for whatever length, actually. At the time, I just very simply felt I want to kind of study abroad, kind of continue in my postgraduate studies and stuff. And I just, a bit unfortunately, my only language ability is English and Mandarin, of course. So I couldn't consider many other country. And USA and Canada or Australia are not really, I think, something I like. It's really hard to describe, not to make them sound bad. It just, I feel like in terms of art and culture, I think I'm more curious, let's put it that way, what is happening in Europe or something like that. So I chose to study in UK. That's kind of it's not like I have a fascination towards UK. It's just more about, that's the options I got. If I speak other language, I might end up somewhere in Europe or something like that.
Now, this may sound like a little bit of an ignorance question, but you did mention the US. The reason why I'm asking this is that I thought Taiwan had a really close relationship with the US. So would it not be easier to study in the US?
I think historically, definitely, yes. But I think probably somewhere around my generation, my age and onwards, I think more and more people started to consider UK. Of course, historically, I think USA has a closer relationship with Taiwan. But I guess especially, I really don't know other industry, I think I shouldn't say that. But I think especially in terms of art and culture, I think the style in USA and the philosophy or logic or whatever method in USA is quite different from the ones in Europe. So I think that kind of just a little bit set it apart, depends on what style or things you're more interested in, and then you choose which path you want to go. I will say that.
Returning to Taiwan after your studies, was that always part of your plan?
I think it's interesting. I think I was asked the question a lot. I just don't plan things. Like, I think even now, I don't know how long I'm going to stay here. Like, I also got friends asking me that, oh, so are you moving back for good? I said, well, you never know. I might move back. I might move elsewhere. So I think since I moved there, I never thought about how long I will stay. I'll just stay if I want to stay. And when I felt like I had enough, so I moved back. That's it.
Now, let's talk about your work. So if I would meet you at a dinner party and I wouldn't know you, how would you describe your own work or what you do?
Lately, like, I just signed up for driving classes. I wanted to get a driving license. And my instructor kept asking me, what do you do? I don't know why. And then I said, an artist. And I think he's trying to find something in common. Like, oh, you're an artist, you must know this. Like, so, you know, this is rolling this just like rolling your paintbrush or something. You know, like, I think he's trying to find something in common, and he was actually really annoying. And so he keeps saying, like, so are you a painter? And I say, no, I really don't want to talk about my work. I just want, you know, learn how to drive. And he keep asking, and to the point I know how to shut him up. And so I said, what do you do? And I say, post-colonialism. And like, he was like, what? Like, and I felt like I knew that would work. So like, we stopped the topic. But that's a very simplified version of what I'm interested in. I guess as an immigrant in Europe, and you know, I'm sure you understand, like, Taiwan is also quite unique in terms of its political position. Initially, I think I was and still am very interested in post-colonization and racial theories in a broader term, such as like migrant experiences, you know, diaspora, racial, national identity, etc. But I think fundamentally, more and more I realize, I think what I'm really interested in is not just the theory itself, it's also the people who experience this theory. So I work a lot with other immigrants or people who have certain migrant experiences or even historical event that's related to certain diaspora experiences or migrant experiences, stuff like that. But it's not limited to that. I think it's just one of the main thing I'm particularly interested in. So yeah, if it's at a dinner party, I think I will answer something like that. Yeah.
You mentioned several big topics. So let's begin with post-colonialism. Is there a specific area that you focus on within this specific domain? What more can you say about post-colonialism?
I think to talk about post-colonialism in Taiwan is very, very different to talk about the term in the UK. And funnily, I think being British educated, I would put it that way, that I actually don't think I'm the best person to talk about post-colonialism of Taiwan. And yeah, now I'm very curious about if I was educated in Taiwan, how would I feel, and do people talk about it in their courses? I don't know. So yeah, I think it does definitely pose a difficulty for me, like, after moving back, especially initially, I guess, like when I just moved back, like to re-find my position in the society. Like, I think in UK, I don't want to use the word naturally too much, but yeah, I work a lot with, you know, I position myself as an immigrant. I position myself with, I talk about disappearing Chinatown and Limehouse. I talk about migrant experiences from the Windrush generation, you know, despite, of course, I'm not from the West Indies, but like certain experiences. I work with a book, like Lao She wrote a book called Mr. Martin's Son. It was his experience. It's a fictional book, but based on part of his experience of living in UK. He's a Chinese writer in the, well, I don't want to say the year wrong. I think prior to the Second World War anyway. Like, so I think I kind of like very comfortable in that position. I talk about a lot of things. I'm moving back, and I think Taiwan is, speaking of post-colonialism, it's in a very weird position, like, because you could argue about, you can talk about Japanese and how post-colonial position that we are in. But honestly, if you really ask me, I think we're still in a certain colonial situation about who we are, like, are we Chinese, are we Taiwanese, what language we actually speaking in, the position of indigenous in Taiwan. So I think it's really complicated to talk about it. And also something I'm learning is how different these post-colonial stories and history will vary, depends on where you are. Like, what I'm trying to say is try not to use what I learned in UK imposed on Taiwan. Like, I think the Jamaican story and Taiwanese stories will be completely different. Of course, there's things in common, but doesn't mean everything can work on that case. And so, yeah, so after moving back to Taiwan, of course, I did a lot of other things as well, but I also did like a couple projects with like migrant workers here. Now I started to think what I do. It's a bit complicated, I guess. I'm for example, like, I still did a lot of artists in residency. Like, I went to Vienna this year, and last year I went to Paris. In Paris, I did a project based on Chou Miaojing, is a Taiwanese writer who committed suicide in Paris in 1995. So I did a project based on that book, a book she kind of wrote before she died, with other immigrants in Paris. And in Vienna, I work with like a local participant to swim and talking about the concept of island and utopia and community. So it's not always, I mean, about post-colonialism. It's just more a word I want my driving instructor to, you know, shut up. But yeah, it's a broader sense of what I do, I guess. Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, you said something about how colonialism is different depending on where you are. What is your understanding of colonialism in the UK and Taiwan?
I think in Taiwan, people don't really talk about colonial too much, if I'm being honest. But I also, again, I cannot represent, you know, the whole country, because I'm sure a lot of people would be upset about that if their research is about the colonialism, you know, the colonial history in Taiwan. But just in the arts in general, in what I experience, I feel like we don't talk about it as much as we talk about it in the UK, because I think UK has a very, I mean, we all know how many countries, you know, UK colonized and how it's still residue nowadays. Even just a few years ago when I was there, there was this debate of there are some elderlies of Windrush generation who was being deported because they never applied for a passport. It's a really ridiculous story, you know. And for example, like, after the political turmoil in Hong Kong, there are a lot of like Hong Kongese I know, like, moved to UK as well. And how, you know, this image of a good immigrant of Hong Kongese and in comparison with the not so good immigrants from, I don't know, probably West Indies, is again, stirred a debate in the UK, like, before I left. So I think it's really interesting, like, you know, this is still something, even though colonial history sounds like a very long time ago, but this is still continuing happening, and this, you know, in within this discussion, and influence people's life daily. And like, I have you know, this Chinese British friend, a Hong Kongese British friend, like, they are born and raised as second or third generation, but, you know, do they consider British or not? Some of my performer actor friends still being asked to do an accent when they were being, you know, auditioned, things like that. And I think in Taiwan, like, funnily, it's not too far. I think on the contrary, it's too present. Like, we don't know how to talk about this because, yes, I guess the only kind of like on the paper colonization history is Japan. But again, back to what we were saying, like, I think we're still debatable, like, are we currently being colonized? I think someone will say yes, someone will say no. We don't even know what is the thing we racially, I think most, apart from indigenous and immigrants, many of us are racially Chinese, and we all have ancestors from the big continents on our left, let's put it that way. So it's really difficult to really talk about the so-called post-colonialism or even colonialism itself, I would say so. So I think that itself is a very different experience. And so I think, like, at first, I think to simplify what I learned, of course, I felt like, okay, colonization's bad. It's just like, there's no discussion, it's bad. But in Taiwan, I think because what the position we're in, of course, a lot of people still, especially some elderly or even different second, third generation, still feel like, okay, Japan is, there's not much hatred or anger towards Japan. I feel like people still consider Japan did Taiwan good even. And at first, I feel quite hard to understand because what I learned of colonization is bad. Like, you know, they are bad people and we are suffering. But then I think you just can't use every case, the theory just on every case. Every case is case by case and every individual's experiences are valid. Like, they have their right to believe in a certain way because what happened afterwards might be worse or you know, it's complicated. So moving back for all these years, and I'm also trying to understand, like, things are case by case and every theory is valid. Like, you can't really say your experience is wrong. You need to believe in things in this way. And this is, I think, one of the very big differences I felt.
Is it fair to say that you are attracted to really complex subjects?
I guess so, yeah.
So what will probably help to get a better understanding of the subject and research you conduct is to delve into your work and projects. Let's begin with a recent work that you made that has a very catchy title, The Moments When You Suddenly Remember You Can Swim. What can you say about this work?
So yes, that was the project I did in Vienna. And so what happened was, actually the whole kind of research towards the concept of idea and utopia started in 2020. And I was part of an online residency with Jim Thompson Art Center in Bangkok and in collaboration with Hong Kong Museum in Taipei. And that was like during the time of COVID, and I think they want to experiment with different forms of artists in residency. So it was online, and I think there were like four, I can't remember the number, I think there are 4 to 6 artists from Thailand and artists from Taiwan. We regularly meet online, we share informations, and we share our researches, and we do a project. And of course, it's really, really different from physical residency. I think a lot of things still physical residency cannot be replaced. So yeah, so long story short, during that period of time, I started to look into the concept of island and utopia. And as you know, I'm sure most of us know, like, the concept of utopia was coined by Thomas More, and it was an island. Like, the British writer imagined an island. And I think island really provides all sorts of possible potential environment for an utopia or even dystopia, you know, to be born, because it's isolated. And also island in many people's imagination has this concept of, you know, this tropical, exotic, and, you know, this unique, because it's how it's secluded and isolated. So anything can happen here. So I was researching on all this island as a stereotype, as a concept. And I particularly at the time, I was looking into something called Phantom Island. So Phantom Islands are islands that was officially on maps at some points in history, but proven to be not existed. So probably it was the most recent one was even literally just satellite mistake. There was a smudge on the satellite. And for some reason, like, even Google Map picked it up, and it was only erased in 2012, I think, or 2016. So because especially a lot of island in a very remote area, like, especially in the past, like during the exploration time, you know, in the 14th to 16th century, a lot of explorers, they claim they see an island and they put it on the map because they want to get more funding. And it's so easy to say there's an island than to prove the island doesn't exist, because someone had to actually, you know, imagine at the time to take a boat, to go there and to prove it doesn't exist. And how many people need to say it doesn't exist to make it officially removed on the map? So long story short, there's a lot of islands like that. And all the islands have its own reason to be born. Some of them based on a certain religious idealism. Some of them was born just, like I say, like out of greed because they want more funding. But it's really interesting about, you know, all these images of the island and how it relates to utopia. So anyway, that was another project I did. And the Vienna Saletto, it's a residency organization, and they had an open call. And I look into their website, and it's a farm and with a very beautiful swimming, kind of like a lake area where people can swim. And I instantly thought about my previous research about island utopia. And because even during that project, in the online project, I was thinking, if island is the utopia, then swimming is a social movement. Because, you know, what we do for social movement is we want to be closer to the ideal society we want to live in, right? So we go on protests, we go on things. And at the time, Thailand has a very big protest. And one particular footage I found on Twitter, I loved it, it inspired me a lot, is two protesters, because they closed all the roads to the parliament. They want to block all the protesters, but there was a river in the back of the parliament. So there are two protesters literally put their, what do you call, petition on the back with the plastic bag sealed, and they swam to the parliament to hand in the petition. And I was really moved by that. So long story short, I worked with my partner. We made a video game that you can swim to an island, but you never arrive because the concept of, you know, utopia is something you can never reach. And I did another video that incorporated with this video footage of these two guys swimming. I always feel like swimming is something like in life. I mean, if you're walking on land, you don't need to keep thinking of surviving, but in water you need to do a certain action so you don't drown. So I felt like swimming really has, for me, has a, I don't know, even metaphorical or either physical experiences of trying to survive. And then that link to the concept of if islands utopia, then swimming is such a movement that how we approach to it. So long story short, for that project I work with 5 local residents. So they all have certain connection to that area, particularly in Vienna, because it's a bit outside of Vienna. So we did a, how do we call it? Like discussion, probably. It's not a conference or workshop. So we just meet up, and it's recorded as well. And I invited them to talk about what does swimming mean to them? What does this area mean to them? What does utopia, their ideal utopia is? So we did a kind of workshop. So we kind of discuss what our, if 5 of us, well, including me, 6 of us, have to build an utopian island, how it's going to be like. And based on that discussion, we actually built a little island, but I mean, it's like probably 60 centimeter by 60 centimeter. It's very small, and it's empty bottle tied together and decorated with stuff. And so during the performance, I put the island in the middle of the lake river area, and I invited 5 of them to swim towards it and put a little item that represent the utopia on top of the island. And the discussion we did about utopia and the process of this performance. And I also personally did a lot of footage of me swimming towards the island, swimming in general. And it was edited into a 3-channel video installation. So yeah, that was the project. It was really, really fun. I enjoy swimming there so much. It's really beautiful, and people were really, really nice. And the discussion was, for me, it's even more interesting than I expected to see a group of people, even for a very short period of time. We did like 2 hours only, but just to discuss and to compromise, because my utopia might not be your utopia. How these 5 people, to see these 5 people compromise their vision and changing their minds through the process, and to collectively build something that suits all 5 of them. It's really interesting, yeah.
If you don't mind, can you share more of the feedback of the participants? What, for example, did they say about the notion of an island? Did they describe it in terms of size, psychological or geographical terms, or something else? Can you speak more about this?
I think, again, I was really fortunate to work with these 5 people. And for example, I remember like one of the participants was very realistic, and he kept saying like, okay, but how do we get the funding for this? Like, and there was like 2 other participants that are very idealistic. Oh, someone was like, I want my tree to have glitters, you know, I want, there's no sickness. And then people start discussing like, do we want sickness? But I actually fine with sickness. I think sickness makes us grow. I just don't. And then themselves like, do we want death on this island? Because I try not to involve, actually. I was sitting behind a camera. I feel like I don't want to set too much rules for them. I'm going to let them discuss. For example, like, do we want sickness? Does sickness help us grow or just suffering? Do we want death on the island? Like, how realistic or unrealistic we want it to be? Like, do we need to think about funding? Do we need to think about money and food and, you know, are we still human? Do we need food to survive? Do we need water to survive? How big is the island? How much natural resources we have? And for example, the other, I think, very interesting discussion is how close we want to be. Do we want, because it's just 5 of them, do we want other people to come on this island or just 5 of us? And some people feel like, no, just 5 of us is going to be so boring. I'm going to end up hating all of you. But other people say, so do we just want anyone to come in? But what if we don't have enough resources? It's an island. How big is the island? And what if there are people we don't agree on come on this island. So people start discussing, but probably we want something closed up so we can have our own space, but also a bridge. We can visit each other. And but others also feel like, but this is so separated. I want it to be a community. So even like, I think there are five people are already, for me, quite like-minded. You know, imagine people would participate in our project like that, are, you know, probably not that conservative, you know, are very open-minded. But even within five people who are already like-minded are still having very different idea about the island they want to build. And it's really, really interesting to see the process, yeah.
The reason why this project really resonates with me is because I live on a small island myself. It's a subtropical island with about 10,000 residents. So many people actually don't know that Hong Kong has about, I think, 263 islands. And of course, not all of them are populated. But if we go beyond the geographical and physicality of an island and look at an island as being a independent or maybe for some an isolated concept, was this also addressed in this project by the participants, the sense of isolation or liberation?
Yeah, I guess it does come into discussion for a bit. I remember one of the participants did mention that she doesn't even like the concept of island because she felt like that's very isolated. She wants to live on more, you know, continental environment. But I guess because the assignment like I gave them is like, if you have to build this island, like some of the discussion are quite, I don't think it's psychological or philosophical, but some of the discussion goes quite practical as well. Like I remember someone mentioned about healthcare, like there should be, you know, a free healthcare for every resident on the island. And some people, of course, talking about like they want to feel recognized. One of the participants is a trans man. He also talked about he wanted to be recognized and be okay with however he wants with his body, like whatever he wears and whatever he want to dance anywhere without feeling uncomfortable. And so yeah, so there's some certain psychological aspect to it, I guess, yeah.
I have a small favor to ask that will make a big impact. The Last Supper is offered to you at zero cost. And if you like this show about art in Asia, give this podcast a star rating or subscribe to this podcast channel. Many thanks and let's continue. Another work that I would like to talk about is turning away from debates that have not been concluded. This was a residency in 2019 for the Archive and Library in Manchester, I believe. Can you speak more about this one?
I think, yes. I try to usually, now the time, but I try to quote some part of from places. Like a lot of titles are, actually both projects you brought up, the sentence I quote somewhere else, like something I read in an article or something I watch in a film or something like that. That was a project I really like as well. Like I did a residency actually right before I moved out. So it was June 2019. And it's actually a very interesting organization as well. Just to talk about the organization itself. It started as something called CAC, Chinese Art Center. It has always been based in Manchester. And Manchester actually has the, well, if I'm not mistaken, I hope I didn't say anything wrong, is the oldest Chinatown in UK and the biggest one outside of London as well. So CAC, and I think it started in 1989, if I'm not wrong. Yeah. And it started as something actually very, the so-called Chinese culture. They do calligraphy, dumpling making, lantern making, and it's more for just like the Chinese immigrants there to have somewhere they can go to feel identified, you know, feel seen and feel like they can repractice things they're familiar with. And then at some point it developed more into contemporary art. And at some point it focused more on the kind of like the Chinese British artist and showcasing these people or Chinese in a very broader tense, like racially Chinese, like Chinese Singaporean, Chinese Malaysian, and all this in diaspora experiences and artists who are of this heritage, etc. And then at some point, they felt like the name CAC, Chinese Art Center, no longer fits them. So they changed the name to CFCCA, which is Center for Chinese Contemporary Art. And that was the time when I had a residency. So when I had a residency, it's called CFCCA. But recently they changed its name again because actually it's all related to this project, the whole history. So lately they changed to ESEA, which is something like Southeast Asia. So long story short, like they broadened the term. I think it's called ESEA Contemporary. And they just broadened the term, like no longer focus on the word Chinese, and it's more to the broader sense of East and Southeast Asia. And my position as a resident artist, I wasn't just a generic resident artist. I was particularly selected for archival resident artists. So I was invited to work with their archives. And as an organization, I actually think they have amazing archives of its own history. It's very, very small, but still, and they have an archivist full-time working there. It's by contrast, I think, she even mentioned to me it was like 2 to 5 years or something, because that was the time. It's also their 30 years anniversary or something. So they just published a book and they work with all their archival material. They even did a project of oral history. Like they collect people's memory of this organization, especially from the local elders in Manchester, Chinese immigrants who was there in the 80s and 90s about what is your memory of this organization. It's actually really, really nice. And so what I did is I focused on a conference, and I think that conference was a turning point of changing the organization's position. That's the reason I mentioned the history as well, from this very Chinese culture, you know, calligraphy and like fan making, dumpling making, into more contemporary art. So in 1998, if I'm right, they did a conference. I can't remember the title right now, but basically they talk about what is this organization's position is. Why do we need this? Why still exist? What do we do? And the term of Chinese, what does the word Chinese mean? Do we like this term? Is it inclusive or exclusive? And so it's an amazingly interesting conference. And funnily, well, I guess it's not funny, but at some point there was a fire that burned down a lot of documentation of the event, or actually a lot of archive in general. So the only thing left of the whole conference is a little booklet. There's no photo or anything. The little booklet was done by an outside. It's really interesting. They hire someone to document this event, but through textually. So for example, they have this timetable of, I think it's a 3-day event or something like that. So they have the timetable of each day, and they have each talk, who are the speaker, who says what. And at the end, there's a discussion. So imagine it's like in court, there's a discussion. Someone say, this audience say this, but this participant argue with this. And like it's written down as a text. And I was fascinated by that because first, as a Taiwanese, I think it's really interesting my position to have a residency in CFCCA. Am I Chinese? Do I identify of being Chinese? If I'm not, do I still allow to have this residency here? And so naturally, I'm fascinated by the word itself, the Chinese is the term. And also like being at the time, being an immigrant and to think about, so there's a very big debate about the organization is it helping or is it limiting? So some people's arguments like, oh, we are marginalized in UK. We don't consider it as mainstream. So it's good that this organization exists to give us a platform, you know, artists, a platform to show our work. But other arguments is that more of this organization still exists. It is the reason we are marginalized, because people think, oh, you're Chinese, you should exhibit it there. You don't belong to Tate or you know, more mainstream museum. And we need to consider ourselves as British as anyone else, because we are as British as anyone else, and to fit in this narrative. So people actually thinking, I know people who are Chinese heritage refuse to work with organizations like that because they feel like they're being put into a pigeonhole. They're being boxed into a certain image. So that debate is really fascinating. And so what I did is I tried to find, there are 19 names being named, I remember, like named in that discussion, like who says what, because a lot of audience, they are also local poets and local artists. So they're actually being documented. And I tried to find all of them. and interview them again after that was like 30 years, do you remember what you say? And do you still believe in that? What do you feel about it now? And I think I found more than six, but I think only six people have time also being interviewed by me. It's just, no, I think I did a bit more than six. I can't remember, probably 6 to 8 or something. So yeah, I managed to interview some of them. A lot of them don't remember what I say, but it's interesting to know what has changed. You know, 30 years is a very long time. Like, do they still hold the same position, or how do they feel? Is it improved? Are they more accepted now? And it's, you know, like I say, there's a debate of how some people say we need to stop playing the race car. Some people are like, okay, but I don't play the race car, I don't have any car to play because I'm marginalized. There's no other thing. And people say, why can't I play the race car? This is my heritage, I'm proud of, you know? And people like, it's a whole debate. So I kind of like work with the existing script from the debate in 1998, combined with the interview I did with these people. And I interview 4 participants in Manchester who, again, are not considered to be white, to put it that way. Some of them are, Naomi, for example, he's Chinese ethnicity, but adopted by white family since she was a kid. And there is like immigrants from different places, from Thailand, from Africa, from different places. I interview them about how they feel as performers of color in Manchester and discuss this context with them. So the discussion with them, the archival information of the conference at the time, plus the interview I did with the previous participants, and I mixed them all together to write a script. And I removed the word Chinese completely from the script. So you kind of keep trying to talk about certain very vague concept, but it's about this identity thing. So yeah, it's a debate that never been concluded. There's 4 people, they stand in a circle, and they keep changing position as the story evolved, and they keep changing their position as well. So position as physical position, but also position as how they see about this. So we kind of repeated 4 times, but every time the story repeated is slightly different. So that was a project I did.
Is it fair to say that in both works we discussed the first one, the moment when you suddenly remember you can swim, and the other one, turning away from debates that have not been concluded, dialogue between the participants is central. And in both projects, you were more of a observer than a participant.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I think I'm more of an observer, but I also think I cannot deny the fact that I'm the one who, what it means, I'm not going to pretend I'm neutral or objective about these both projects, because after all, I'm the one who finalized the script. I'm the one who edited the debate. I'm the one who, you know, select the footage, edit the footage, and set up the rules for things. So definitely a lot of involvement, like I interfere a lot of this process. But yes, I guess I try to discuss this rather than express my opinion.
When you look back at those 2 projects as a curator observer, what did you learn from it yourself?
I think I always learned a lot, at least in my opinion, but sometimes it's a bit hard to pinpoint what exactly. But I guess, for example, like in the 2019 project, I particularly remember one of the interviews I did was Quan Lee, and he's an amazing curator. He used to work for CAC, and then he moved on to more the so-called like a mainstream art, Manchester Art Festival, etc., etc. And I really love the way he sees identity. I remember he was talking about, like, he used to consider himself, he's originally from Hong Kong, but I think he moved to UK at the age of 2. So he's way more British than any other identity. I think he was saying, like, he used to consider himself as Chinese British, but he no longer. He felt like he want to consider himself as British. But I remember he was saying, like, but one day I might consider myself a Chinese British again. He feel like identity is fluid, and there shouldn't be one answer of you are or you are not. I can change my mind anytime I want, and it is supposed to be up to that person. And that's something I really think I want to apply that attitude as well. I think we constantly debate about what's the line of you're British or not. Am I British or not? You know, is it depends on your passport or it depends on your life experiences? You know, it depends on your race, you know, all the thing. And I feel like, for example, in a more recent project I did, there's a debate also about, are you an immigrant? And, you know, are you an expat, which is a word I really don't like, you know? So I feel like at the end of the day, we should allow people to identify themselves. And we should stop trying to set definition to those words. I think, like, if you think you are this, then you are this. End of the story. Like, we shouldn't challenge or debate about, oh, but you're not. You know, I think that's really unfair. I think that's something that I carried with since the project. And so yeah, that's something came to my mind. Like, I really appreciate it, yeah.
If you don't mind, I have a follow-up question about identity and how we identify ourselves in relation to labels. Can you talk more about if we cannot identify other people, or as you said, it is better for people to use their own identification instead of imposing it on other people?
I remember, like, this was actually discussed in the work in CFCCA I made as well. Again, I want to quote someone. This is not from me. I can't remember who said that. But I also love that this part of the discussion, like, probably it would be better to use a paragraph rather than a word. This is literally like the lines from the script. Like, it's not to discuss identity. You know, we all have something we attach ourselves to, either gender or race or nationality or culture. Of course, you identify with a certain larger group that you think you're part of, the member of this group. But I think, again, everyone is very unique. And like we discussed at the beginning, like, as a Taiwanese, I don't represent other Taiwanese. A lot of people might really disagree with me. So probably this one of the solution is using an article, a paragraph, rather than a word. Like, do not simplify, like, you are just this. For example, I was an immigrant, but I was also annoyed when sometimes if a curatorial statement talking about me as continuously emphasizing, oh, me being an immigrant. And I also feel like I'm not just that, you know? And I felt like it's important to always recognizing everyone's individual. And it's way more complicated than just the label. But yeah, I am not agree with terminology. I think we can continue talking about terms. And that's the reason, for example, they changed their name from CAC to CFCCA to now ESEA. And I think that all means something. I do think discussing terminology is potentially necessary, but I guess not to simplify it, it's important.
The last project I'd like to discuss with you is the project you did for the Steel Art Festival in Taiwan. Do you mind explaining what you did for this?
It was honestly, it was a kind of really odd invitation, like, because I actually think the official name is not Steel Art Festival. I was the one translated into that way. I think it's called like Steel Sculpture or Steel something like that festival. So it's a festival, Kaohsiung Pier 2. It's an organization in the south of Taiwan. They did it for years already. I don't know how many years. It started as, I think, because Kaohsiung is an industrial city and there are several like steel or iron like factory. They started as inviting artists to use the scrap metal. So the government wants to kind of like, they invited the companies that have scrap metals to donate to artists to make sculptures. And that's as simple as that. So it started as quite, I wouldn't use the word conservative, but like quite traditional sense of sculpture and in a public area, public art. So it was not a festival that I follow or I particularly, you know, study into. And however, the curators this time, they wanted to do something different. As a duo curators, I knew them for a while as well. And they knew that I did several projects in the past regarding like immigrants or migrant workers in Taiwan. So they invited me to do a project with the migrant workers in the south in the steel industry, because they feel like they want to talk something more than just the material itself, also the people who work in this industry. So I think it's a good idea. So I did this project, and I actually think it's one of my lighter projects. It's really fun because some of my projects are very, you know, heavy. And like my previous project, like I mentioned, is about this Taiwanese writer who committed suicide in Paris. It's extremely dark and heavy. But yeah, so this is relatively light. So at first, I had difficulty finding people to interview. And so I use social media, which is Facebook, because luckily, because of my previous project, I am part of some of the migrant workers groups already. So I just posted like, okay, I'm looking for people working in English. I was looking for people working in steel industry in Kaohsiung to interview. And it's an art project, there's a pay, blah, 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 please get in contact. And funnily, I'm sure you understand the word interview means two different things. More than two different things, but I didn't realize that. So a lot of people contact me, thought I was offering a job. They thought it's a job interview. And I realized, oh shit, that's what I meant. And so I have to explain like, no, it's not that type of interview. I just want to know how you feel about working in the industry. I want to know your life. It's not, so how much is the pay? Like when is a working day? It's only, and I said, no, it's not. So it's like a communication error to the point I think it's quite funny. But meanwhile, while it's funny, you also realize that how many of the workers who are desperately needing a job. Because at first, I thought it's a very good gig. You know, you only need to spend your 1 hour. You don't need to do any prep. Well, probably like 2 hours, let's say 2 to 3 hours. And you'll be paid with 2,000 Taiwanese dollar. That's it. Just showed up. Any location, I'll approach you. And turn out, it's really hard to find these people because people are not interested in this temporarily small money. They want the real job. Everyone just like, oh, okay, you don't have a job, then I'm not interested because I want a job. I need something to support my living, to support my visa so I can stay. And I think this is a very middle-class mentality. Feel like, oh, this is a good gig. But then I realize people's lives, you know, are different. And also the other thing that's interesting is so many people thought I was a YouTuber. Once they realized it's an interview, they say, oh, you're a YouTuber. I said, no, I'm an artist. But like, no, I understand what an artist does. And so the conversation become quite interesting at the same time. So I decided to make this process as part of the work. So I did a video. I translate everything into Chinese because I feel like that's an audience can relate. And of course, I cover all the identities. And so I made a video. You can see my conversation with them live as if it's like a screenshot of the phone. It's kind of like a little bit animated, but it's all based on real conversation I had with overall, I think there were like 20 people I talked to. And so it's like all this conversation, half of them I made into a video. And the other half of them I made into a line, kind of like a WhatsApp. It's like a messaging service in Taiwan. So I made a line interactive game, not game, like a theater. So I invited, there's a script will be provided on site. And audience are invited to scan a QR code and to follow the script to talk to me. So they will be playing the role of migrant workers. I translate everything into Chinese again. So they type while the migrant workers talk to me. And I made a bot. I mean, I wouldn't be online all the time. So I made a bot of me reply what I actually replied to them. But on the script, they don't see my reply. So they have to follow the script to type to see what I say to them. And they have to kind of like force them to put themselves in the shoes of the migrant workers who talk to me, who ask for a job and who mistaken me as a YouTuber or you know, not understanding the interviews for it. So that was part of the project. So luckily, eventually, I managed to find someone who was willing to be interviewed. And I asked him if he can bring his friends. So there's four of them. And at first, I don't know what I'm interviewing. Honestly, I just trying to understand their life. And I asked very generic question. And then I decide what to do. And then I realized I'm from the north. I'm from Taipei. And I realized, oh, there's so many places. At some point, I don't know why we started to talk about the places that I like to go in Taiwan. They start recommending me, oh, this place is so fun. This mountain is really pretty. Oh, this is a restaurant we like to go. Because I was asking, what do they do? And I feel like, oh, I learned so much about Taiwan, like my country. I learned so much from them. And then I decided, I felt that would be fun. Oh, I actually have it here. I mean, I know it's not a visual podcast, but I have it here. So I made this. It's a pamphlet, like of title is Still F4, which is a Taiwanese drama like they also know and watch. And I kind of trying to make a joke, Still F4's travel guide to Southern Taiwan. And that's their kind of photos. And I work with the graphic designer as well. I didn't design this. And this is all like the touristic spot or the restaurant or the shopping places like they recommended. And so, yeah, we made this for people to take away. And there's a little bit introduction about who they are as well. I think it's really fun. You know, I think this is a process, right? At first, there's a discrimination towards migrant workers, you know, people from Southeast Asia in Taiwan. And then at some point, we started to realize that. And there's a, you know, oh, poor them. I mean, I'm not saying it's not poor them, definitely poor them. There's a lot of narratives focus on the very sad situation that they are facing. But I also feel like it's also important to humanize them, just to really see them. They are as people like you and me, and they have things they are interested in. And I think tour guide, especially Pier 2 itself, is a very touristic spot. And I feel like a lot of people might be tourists there. And I think it's really interesting in a non-didactic way to learn from these migrant workers about our own country, like to really know this place we actually live in through their lens. So yeah, so this is the project I did.
It's not possible to discuss all your projects today. So what else are you working on, Ting-Ting?
So yeah, so this year, so I worked with a group of Taiwanese artists and artists based in Germany to make a publication. That was like a year-long project that we ended this summer. So currently this book is being traveled to many cities and book fairs. And in December, there's book fairs in Taiwan. I will be participating in with the books as well with fellow couple other artists. And that was a very interesting project. I'm very happy to work on that. And like I mentioned, the Steel Art Festival that's currently going on, the project made with migrant workers. I actually just finished a project, again, the one I mentioned. It was finished probably like, yeah, a week ago, Solid Art with the Contemporary Gallery in Taipei, exhibiting the project I did in Paris related to the writers who commit suicide in Paris. And I work with several immigrants in Taiwan as well who, so I was working with immigrants in Paris who recite the letters Qiu Miaojing, the writer, wrote before she passed away in Paris. And then I interviewed the immigrants in Paris, and in Taiwan, I invited more like another 9 immigrants in Taiwan to perform with the interview I did with the immigrants in Paris. So it's something I kind of passing down. So we did 2 live performances with a 2 dual channel video installation. And yeah, that was just ended a week ago. And next year, March, I will be participating in a group show in Tainan, showing an old work of mine. There's something called Blue Willow Pattern. So something looks super Chinese, but actually was invented by a British designer, because at the time, like the porcelain from China or from the East are more popular. So they designed this fake, you know, this I don't know how to pronounce that word in French. You know, as a word, chinoise, see? It's like something like this fake Chinese. Anyway, it's a European term. Like they made things very oriental, very, you know, Chinese. So I was mimicking, there's another project that was the video of talking about the history, but the other projects I keep drawing, continuously drawing this play on paper play as a Asian person, kind of like ironically talking about how an Asian person learning who we are through a very colonial past from the British narrative. So things like that will be exhibited in Tainan Art Museum in a group show. I think that's it for my upcoming project. And I'm aiming to have at least 1 residency per year, hopefully in Europe, because I still like to visit all my friends there. I still have lots of friends in Europe. But again, I'm not limited to that. And I actually haven't started applying for anything because I feel a bit overwhelmed with whatever I had. So, but I'm sure soon, probably around December, after all this project ended, I will start applying for things for next year. And again, hopefully I can have a residency somewhere else in the world.
A let's jump to the last question of today. And you may already know what this is about, but if you were to have your final meal, who would you invite and what would you discuss at your last supper?
I feel like if I really have the opportunity to talk to people I can never ever talk to because they have passed away, if there's some granted wish or something, I would love to invite Duell Hall, which is a British writer, theorist who passed away, and Chiu Miao-jing, the Taiwanese writer I mentioned who committed suicide in Paris. And I would love to. I think it's because in 2017, I did a residency in Struer Hall Library in Inner Vine, London. So I did a project revolves around Struer Hall's interview on BBC Radio. That's an island disc. Yeah. So long story short, like I felt like, and not to mention like the project I just mentioned, I did with Chiu Miao-jing's text, the book she wrote before she passed away. And working with people who are no longer there, it's always posed a certain insecurity, anxiety inside of me, like, am I doing it right? What if they're actually very offended by what I do? What if I misunderstood their words? What if they don't like the way I do with their material? I would love to have a chance to have dinner with them and to just ask their opinion about the word. Like, do you guys like it? Or you're actually really offended by it? And what do you think? Like, yeah, I would love to if there's a chance, yeah.
It's been a real pleasure to talk with you today, Ting Ting. All the best with your upcoming projects, and I hope to see you in Taiwan or UK or somewhere where our paths cross again.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of The Last Supper with artist Ting Ting Chen. If you like this show about art in Asia, you can support us by giving this episode a star rating and subscribing to this podcast. If you have any questions, suggestions, or wish to participate in this podcast, you can contact me on oscar@thelastsupper.asia. You can visit my website www.thelastsupper.asia as well, or contact me direct on Instagram @thelastsupper.asia.